You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 3rd of December 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
Are post-Omicron travel restrictions a worldwide slamming of stable doors? Germany's word of the year revealed. And where the streets have new names. Rural France is compelled to adopt addresses. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. It's Friday, so it's our weekly in-house Monocle Daily. Chris Chermak fled to Zurich, but that has turned out to be not far away enough, and failing to save herself here in London was Chiara Ramella. They'll discuss all the day's big stories, and our On This Day historical feature will recall Australia's brief flirtation with insurrection. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today here in London by Monocle's culture editor, Chiara Ramella, who is right here in the studio, and from Zurich by our news editor, Chris Chermak. Welcome to you both. I should also make the point, I think, and I am just managing the expectations of our listeners here, that today's producer, Carlotta Ribello, is doing this remotely as well. Literally nothing can possibly go wrong. Chris, first of all, in Zurich, how are things?
Things are good. Thank you for having me. As you said, I didn't manage to escape far away enough to not join this show, but it's good to be here from Zurich, from our studio here. If you do hear some background noise, that is because it is an hour later here at 7 p.m. and the cafe and the areas behind us are alive and kicking. It's good to be here. There's going to be a Christmas market here in Zurich tomorrow and Sunday. So really, I just escaped to have a second round of Christmas markets, Andrew, because I was at the London Christmas market of Monocle last weekend, and now I'm here for Zurich. So, I mean, you can't get any better than that, can you?
Well, let's see if Chiara can. Chiara, he is at a Christmas market in Zurich. Can you beat that?
Well, obviously not. Also, I would like to make the point that I only agreed to be on the show because Chris was going to be on it. Of course, this has got nothing to do with
who am I?
We just have a connection.
It's the dream team, I know.
Yeah, exactly. We have a connection.
You want to host it? Chiara, go ahead. I can go out and get some shopping done. It's fine.
I have tried to for the coup, but it's just never quite materialised. Perhaps one day. One day, Andrew. We can only hope.
Okay. Well, let us move along to the first topic of discussion, which is that many governments have reacted to the recent identification of another variant of COVID-19, Omicron, by imposing or reimposing travel restrictions, many locking out the southern African countries with which it was initially identified. However, Omicron has now been confirmed in at least 24 countries scattered all over the world, including in people whose connections to Southern Africa have proved tenuous at best, all of which calls into question the value of travel bans. While there is no doubt that the virus moves less when people move less, a calculation does need to be made of what other costs this incurs. Chris, where you are in Switzerland, what is the latest on this? Because they did impose travel bans and now appear to be thinking they might have been a bit hasty.
It is interesting here, Andrew, in part because they imposed travel bans that even went further than many countries. I mean, many countries basically responded to this variant coming out of Southern Africa instead and said, okay, we're going to stop travel from Southern African nations. Switzerland was sort of more aggressive than that. They also banned a number of European countries or imposed quarantine. So even from the UK, you were actually not allowed to travel here without quarantining. The only reason I'm actually here, and we might be getting to that in a second, is because I came via Austria and I was there for the last few days. But they have now, as of today, sort of quietly reversed that. They basically had a rash of announcements here from the government, essentially tightening restrictions on domestic movements, but loosening the restrictions when it comes to people coming into the country. So they've moved from quarantines to requiring a PCR test when you arrive in Zurich, in Switzerland instead. And, you know, I just personally have to say, I just think that makes a lot of sense. It's been interesting to hear, you know, the World Health Organization, the United Nations, all of these international groups that have been saying this week that, you know, travel bans do not necessarily make sense. They punish those countries that have first announced that a new variant was in existence, even though we probably all knew full well that it was also present in other countries as well at this point. You really can't stop the virus easily from crossing borders. You said at the top there that, you know, what you have to do is stop it from moving around. But that's not a border issue, is it? It's more, to me, it feels like it's more of a community spread in so many cases issue. You have to stop it moving around in cities, you know, encourage people to distance, those kinds of things. Obviously, most first and foremost, absolutely, is to just get vaccinated because that limits the spread. But the actual travel ban aspect of this, to me, never quite made sense, given how many countries end up having it within their borders. Why, you know, what is it about a border that really is where we hang our heads and say, this is what we need to do to stop the variant from spreading? So Switzerland is interesting that they sort of did both in that sense. They got very aggressive. They had a somewhat knee-jerk reaction. And then a week later, all of a sudden, they switched and sort of saw the light of that and said, well, we don't actually need to quarantine everybody. It impacts businesses here. Obviously, Switzerland is a very global nation, has so many connections with countries around the world, business connections in particular. So there was an uproar in that sense. And today there was just a huge amount of relief that it means people can travel again, even if, yeah, you have to test. Just like when I now come back to the UK, I will have to get a test and I'll have to self-isolate until I get the results of that test. But that to me makes sense. I don't know if I'm a bigger risk than anybody else at this point in the UK itself, for example, of having Omicron.
Chiara, do you get the sense that we are now coming up for the second anniversary of the proper outbreak of COVID-19, that governments have learned anything about the messaging? Is it all getting any clearer, or do you still feel like everyone's winging it furiously?
Well, if we have anything to learn from what Chris was saying just then, there is a sense that people have acted in a very knee-jerk way. And I do find it really frustrating when WHO advice is against what the countries are doing. And we've been in that situation before. And I do think that throughout, I found it very frustrating that WHO advice has not been followed by everyone at the same time. And I think that it undermines the directives if countries decide to go about it in their own different ways. So in that respect, I do think that the messaging hasn't necessarily improved. I also think that, you know, there are countries that have made such huge mistakes with messaging that it's almost too late to rectify it now. I mean, and I'm speaking particularly about the UK because it is the place where I'm based and where I've witnessed this kind of unfolding. The decision a few days ago in response to Omicron to say, you know, masks are now mandatory again on public transport and in shops. Is it going to be taken seriously? Can it be taken seriously if in July all of those restrictions were taken away? It's very hard, I think, we have experienced, and we've seen that also with, you know, progressive lockdowns, to kind of go back on what you've said in the past. And so in that respect, I don't think that the UK is almost past salvaging, I think, in that respect.
Chris, as you cunningly foreshadowed, you have also been visiting Austria, which is, well, now quite locked down for people who are unvaccinated and planning to get even more so. They will be making it compulsory from February. How different did that feel from either where you are now or here in London?
Well, first of all, Andrew, actually, in Austria at the moment, it is locked down also for the vaccinated. That's what's quite striking in Austria. The reason that I was there was that I had planned a skiing vacation for this week. And of course, that didn't work out. But then I just decided, well, I might as well still visit my parents. But it was a slightly strange experience, I gotta say, to go to fly into one of the few countries in the world that is currently under lockdown. But so it was sort of going back to, you know, 2020 in that sense, to be honest. It does feel very much like that. Everything is shut. The shops are shut. There is a little bit more, it's fair to say, movement around than there was in 2020. You know, I was remarking on this, or, you know, while I was there, that just this, you know, in 2020, we also felt like we couldn't even go outside. That obviously is not the case anymore. And so it feels like there is still life on the streets of Vienna in a way that there wouldn't have been, say, a year ago when this was going on. And some shops are sort of making more efforts to do things like curbside pickups and all those things that we remember so well from 2020 as well. So there was some life on the streets, but you know, Christmas markets are not open there. They're not going to be open again until hopefully on the 13th of December. That's when the lockdown will end, at least for those who are vaccinated. But to your point, Andrew, the question of what to do with those who are not vaccinated continues in Austria. At the moment, the idea would be that they will stay in lockdown, which is something that Germany has actually just essentially done today as well, to say that those who are unvaccinated have to stay basically indoors and cannot really go out much in public. That seems to be one of the steps that a number of countries are taking. The one thing I'd also say is just to follow on from the conversation before about travel. It's interesting because this hasn't felt like a knee-jerk reaction. This has felt, especially in Austria, more like a all-hands-on-deck escalation-type reaction, which has been interesting to watch. And I think we did sort of see this last year as well. It's this consistent sort of underestimating how much of an impact the virus is going to have, slowly trying to introduce restrictions that make sense, that aren't too much, that aren't too serious, and then realizing that it's not enough because hospitals are continuing to overflow with patients and those kinds of things that really show you that this still is a crisis. And so Austria just really felt like it had no choice but to lock everyone down. And now it's going to take the step of requiring vaccinations. And it's just been interesting to watch that so many European nations said they would never consider such a move and now are kind of feeling forced into it as if they have no real alternative. Personally, I don't really know what the answer is. We could debate this, you know, for such a long time in terms of whether vaccine mandates make sense or not. But it feels like so many governments are just kind of backed into a corner with, you know, hospital rates still rising and something that they don't want to deal with. They're trying to get hospital rates down. And the only way to do that is either to lock down everybody or take a really strong step to lock down or have those who are not vaccinated get vaccinated. There really isn't much of another alternative as much as we're having these fights in society right now.
Well, indeed. And we will doubtless be talking more about this in coming days, especially given news just in from Ireland is reimposing certain restrictions. In hospitality venues, you will need a meter between tables, 6 adults per table, no multiple table bookings, maximum 50% capacity at indoor events, face masks to be worn at all times when not eating or drinking. But let's move along to publishing news from Italy, to the effect of a spike in book sales, up somewhere between 12 and 16% year on year. And physical bookstores are hanging on to just over half of that trade. This is prima facie good news, though an adjustment of that assessment may have to be made at such a time as we discover whose books Italians are actually buying. Chiara, I can tell you that as of my last royalty statement, they're not buying any of mine. So whose books are your people buying?
It's interesting, actually. I did look, and the top three on the list at the moment are one Italian author and then one French. So it's a bit of a mix. Italians are not necessarily kind of so Anglophone in their reading habits, and they're very, very keen on their internal markets as well. So it's quite interesting. There are centre countries that just go with the kind of international bestsellers, but there is a very, very healthy publishing industry in Italy itself. And I think this is proof. These figures, I think, are really, really interesting because Italy is bucking the trend in Europe. It's not that automatic that physical book sales would rise 16% year on year in this time.
No, it's very handy.
So, you know, it is surprising, and it has got to do with pandemic-related buying habits, but not just. We have to take into consideration the fact that Italy has put in place some political procedures, some laws that have helped the market of books, particularly the trade from independent booksellers. And, you know, perhaps we are seeing the results. Italy was one of the first countries in Europe to decide that there would be a cap on the amount of discount that large chains and Amazon would be able to put on titles. Are we seeing the result? Perhaps. Other countries in Europe, like France, for example, and we have reported on this on a Monocle Minute, have decided to introduce a limit on a minimum cost on the cost of delivery for Amazon, so that people who thought that they would be kind of saving money by buying things on Amazon would rethink and perhaps consider physical sales instead. All of these methods are practical measures that are showing results. We've talked so much about how, you know, we can combat Amazon and how the rise of kind of e-commerce was seemingly unstoppable. And yes, you can go down the route of trying to make the experience of going to a bookshop a fantastic thing where you cherish the physicality of the book. But there are also practical things that governments can do. And in Italy, they have done them, and perhaps we're seeing the results.
Just to follow that up, Chiara, I did want to ask about that specific point about how well physical bookshops have held up. They took a bit of a dip in 2020, which is to be expected because a lot of them were closed, but actually not that big a dip when you think of what they were up against. And in 2021, sales in physical bookshops have almost returned to where they were in 2019. Now, you, as you have just mentioned, the Italian government has put some fairly practical political solutions in place to encourage that, which is great. But is there, at the very real risk of stereotyping your people, something specifically Italian going on there? That idea that you know, shopping should be some sort of social community occasion as well?
I think you could argue that, for sure. Because I think that the Italian high street is very different from the British high street, and that bookstore chains exist, but they've always been quite committed in their approach to selling actually books. You know, it's not like going to WH Smith in the UK, where you see magazines and books and then a bunch of candy that fills the entirety of the store.
And an inexplicable offer to take away a bottle of water if you buy the Telegraph.
Absolutely. Constantly. the famously thirsty readers of the Telegraph. And I think that's got to do with the publishing sector. It's got to do, as you say, with just a general attitude towards retail that is different. You know, people in Italy will go to the butchers to buy their meat, and they will go to the bakery to buy their bread, etc., etc. We still have Edicole, which are newsagents, which are kiosks on the street. Okay, granted, there are problems with newsstand sales in Italy as well. I'm not trying to say that it's all rosy over there, but I think that the infrastructure of the high street is better placed to have independence on its streets than it is here in the UK, and to maintaining those physical spaces, those small little spaces for people to inhabit, does help when it comes to these results at the end.
Just before we take a break, I want to ask each of you in turn, and I will start with you, Chris, in Zurich, as to whether the last 18 months or so of this increasingly tedious pandemic has altered your reading habits or your reading purchasing habits in any noticeable way.
You know, to be honest, Andrew, I was thinking about this, and I've spoken to a few people who I think were similar to me in that, you know, we heard these stories during the pandemic of many people, you know, picking up a book because there was nothing else to do. I was kind of the opposite, I gotta say. In my mind, I was actually, there was something about the pandemic which made you just want to do something completely mind-numbing. I don't know how many other people had that feeling.
In that case, maybe you could buy some of my books.
Maybe. I think you should pass them on to me and we'll see what happens. But there was that feeling. And so I think even a book seemed sometimes like too much of an effort. And I've had other people that I've spoken to who felt the same way. And so I do wonder as well if, you know, that is an element of it, that as we sort of came out of lockdown, ironically for me at least, that was when I started wanting to sit at home with a good book again. It's almost, maybe it was the fact that you were sort of forced to sit at home with a good book that didn't sit well with me. And once you were sort of out and you could be about and about and visit friends again, that's when, you know, now I'm starting to read again, which I wasn't doing before.
And what about you, Chiara? Did you lapse into a trance of catatonic ennui as Chris did, or did you find yourself more interested in reading?
Well, that's my status all the time. No, I think I normally buy a stupid amount of books. And it's stupid because I don't even get through the bunch that I've just bought, and I'm already, and I buy, and I go to shops and I buy four or five. I haven't even finished the first four or five. It's just stupid. I just pile them up. It's a sense of guilt. It just creates this horrible vicious circle that I can't get out of. I receive proofs at the office. I'm drowning in books all the time. And I think that, unfortunately, during lockdown, I didn't really buy online that much because I like that, exactly that. I like going into a shop and coming out with a big bag full of books that I didn't even know before. I liked the discovery. So I went into real rabbit holes of research during lockdown. I researched what specific cookbook I wanted, and I would have 20 tabs on all sorts of different cookbooks and trying to decide the definitive guide to, that would teach me how to cook. So I became very selective on nonfiction, on specific topics, but I didn't buy that much fiction online because that's just not who I am.
Chiara Miller and Chris Chermak, thank you both for the moment. You are listening to The Daily. We will have more from our transcontinental panel right after this.
Allianz is proud to partner The Monocle Daily on Monocle 24. The world is a better place when people have more courage than fear. Especially in uncertain times, people seek stability and confidence. Allianz is there when it matters. By supporting each other and sharing resources across the world, Allianz has helped people to overcome their fears and look to the future with hope. Allianz, confidence in tomorrow.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are our guests Chiara Miller and Chris Chermak. Now, German is famous for its coinages defining those ineffables and intangibles with which other languages struggle. One thinks of Zugzwang, the pressure to do something when doing nothing is the preferable option, or Verschlimmbessern, or ballsing something up even worse by trying to fix it. And one hopes there is also a seven-syllable portmanteau capturing the simmering fury engendered by hearing your language mispronounced by an Australian. Accordingly, great excitement attends the annual announcement by the Society for the German Language of its Word of the Year. And today we discovered 2021's winner, Chris, in Zurich, as the German speaker at this table. Though you're not actually at this table, you're at a whole different table in a completely different country. What is the winner? Reveal it to us.
Repeat after me, Andrew and Chiara. Wellenbrecher.
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 Wellenbrecher. Easy. Chris, easy. What does it actually mean?
Wellenbrecher basically means wave breaker. And this is, surprise, surprise, a pandemic-related word. The idea is what kind of measures were taken to break various waves of the coronavirus pandemic over the last years. That is what we call those restrictions, those measures are what we call in German Wellenbrecher.
I like it. It's utilitarian and no nonsense and declarative.
I would like to enter the Italian candidate for the Italian Word of the Year.
Is that a thing, the Italian Word of the Year,
no,
or is this just something you've made up in your head?
No, because I like a bit of healthy competition with the Germans, and so I'd like
careful now.
I'd like to propose the Italian version of this game, and the Italian word, I think, should be assembramento. Nobody had ever said the word assembramento before the pandemic. It means gathering, large gathering, but nobody, it's not
a lovely word.
It's quite nice, but it's absolutely not used in common parlance. Nobody had used it before 2020, and then
how
suddenly
did nobody gather before this in Italy? What was happening in Italy before the pandemic?
You would think that Italians do like to hang out with each other in large numbers.
I have seen large gatherings of Italians. I have been part of large gatherings of Italians.
But before 2020, they never used to be called assembramenti, so there you go.
It's a nice word. See, now I feel like I should step up to the plate with the Australian lexicon of English, and tragically all I have is people familiar with Australia or Australians may be aware of our mania for abbreviating almost everything, including that which really does not warrant or require abbreviating. I have heard of quarantine being referred to as quazza.
That's excellent.
Very good.
But Chris, there were nine other words on the shortlist. What were the contenders unlucky to miss out?
There were nine other words. So in total of the 10, seven were pandemic related. But I'm going to focus on a couple of others that you will particularly like, Andrew, because you do like, just like me, you have an affinity for German coalition politics, I know. So there's a couple.
I think of little else, Chris.
That's exactly what I thought. So there is number five, for example, we have Ampelparteien, which is traffic light parties, based on the traffic light coalition that brings together the colors of the various parties that have just entered into a coalition in Germany. So that is number five. Another good one that I like is number nine, the Triel. And this is, instead of a duel, a trio, basically. Could we say that in English? A trio, because
trio?
There were three chancellor candidates for the first time in Germany vying to be chancellor. So when they had a debate, it was not a duel, it was a trio.
A bit like what we're having right now, Andrew.
Bit like what we're having right now. My objection to that word, Chris, despite its self-contained poetic dynamic, is that for a proper German neologism, it's just not long enough. I feel like there should be like at least a six-syllable minimum.
Well, that's a fair point. All of these are actually relatively short. Wellenbrecher is one of the largest. I would like to hear all of you, though, say, and I've been trying this with various people, number four on the list, is vaccine mandate. Repeat after me, Impfpflicht.
Impfpflicht.
Chris, before I try this, is this one of those things where if I get it very slightly wrong, I will have said something dreadful about the mothers of all our German listeners?
Not really, just nobody will know what the heck you're talking about. Andrew.
Okay, well, that's not unusual. What is the word again?
Impfpflicht.
Impfpflicht. Yeah, it sounds kind of menacing.
It is a bit menacing, yes. I'll give you that. There's the sound. We kind of like that in German, and it's a tough one for others to pronounce. And then I've just put two of those in one word for you, repeated after each other, Impfpflicht.
Okay. Well, let's move on, I think, to a subject on which all of this multinational panel can agree, which is the absurdity of the French. Because visitors to rural France will know that it is often difficult to find specific locations, and not only because of the malicious amusement derived by spiteful yokels cackling behind their necklaces of onions from dispatching tourists down dead ends. Many streets in France's more bucolic settlements simply do not have names. They have relied for immemorial centuries on the fact that everyone knows where everyone else lives, and the postal service has accustomed itself to delivering letters addressed to Pierre, Burgundy door, three doors down from the Boulangerie, or whatever. But no more. France's parliament is debating a bill which would end this rustic whimsy and enforce the adoption of street names. Chiara, is this a thing in Italy? Are there places in Italy which still refuse to tell anybody where they actually are?
There's an awful lot of strada statale, right? Which just means...
That's another word.
it's not a word, is it? It just means like state road. And so there's state road 56, state road 76. I mean, yes, they're accurate, but I mean, when you're navigating the place and you read it on a map or you read it on an address, it's not exactly helpful.
What about where you come from, Chris? Is Austria just far too organized to put up with such nonsense?
Well, actually, I have to say, if I could say a little story compared to from what you were talking about, my memories particularly were of Quebec and the French Quebecois, where I had a bus driver who trying to take a local bus to lead us to a major waterfall in Quebec City, sat perfectly quiet, drove the bus all the way to the end, to the terminal, not remarking particularly that there were six tourists still meekly sitting in his bus who had missed clearly the stop for the waterfall. So that is a good example of a dead end, if you will. But in terms of that kind of the examples of street names, I was actually thinking of where I grew up, mostly in Brussels. Brussels had this great habit of changing streets as they went on. So you'd have multiple street names for the same street. That's sort of the extra example as well, where you've suddenly moved from one street to the next and you had no idea that you did it. So trying to find an address there was equally tricky for that reason.
I would say another one thing that does happen in Italy is that street names are so common. And I mean, this happens across different countries, right? But it's very, very unlikely that you won't find a Via Roma in literally the smallest possible town in London, Sardinia, like 20 inhabitants, but the main street going down towards the church. Why not call it Via Roma?
I do want to ask you each, just before you are discharged from the panel, if you could rename your street, what you would rename it after. And to, by way of inspiration, I will throw out a story I was once told, reasonably impeccable source, off the record, however, so I cannot name the massively famous Hollywood film star in question. But I was told that this massively famous Hollywood film star had received a call from the mayor of the town he had grown up in and said, like, you know, we're really proud of everything you've accomplished. We would like to name a street after you, just like pick a street and we'll rename it after you. And this massively famous Hollywood film star, and you have to admire this, ask the mayor if a particular person who was the guy who had bullied the film star at school still lived in the town. The mayor replied, yes, he does. And the film star said, that one.
Ah, excellent work.
I'm not sure whether that ever actually occurred or even if it's true, but I do like the idea very, very much. So, Chiara, first of all, if you could rename the street on which you live.
Well, I was thinking about this and I came up with like a serious option that's not so fun.
Go on.
So the serious option is naming it after Natalia Ginzburg, fantastic Italian novelist. We need more Italian people on the streets.
Is she not selling enough books?
She's sold a bit. Anyway, that's beside the point. It's just about world domination. But the thing that I was thinking, you know, a lot of streets are called after the things that are on them. Mm-hmm. There isn't an awful lot on my street apart from houses. So I'd like to call it like what I tell the taxi driver when they turn into my road. You know how you just have to let them understand at what point of the road you're at. Mm-hmm. So I always say, just by the tree on the left. So I would like to call it just by the tree on the left. Street.
That is poetic. Chris, can you improve on that?
I'm really struggling, I gotta say, Andrew, so I'm just gonna go back to the beginning so you can all say it again. What about Wellenbrecherstraße?
Wellenbrecherstraße. On that note, we will say thanks to our panel, that is Chris Chermak on Wellenbrecherstraße and Chiara Ramella here in the studio in London. Finally, on today's show, our regular On This Day feature considers the closest Australia ever came to civil war, which it turned out wasn't very. Australian politics is known for being robust and rowdy and for being conducted by abrasive and combative figures.
The Leader of the Opposition slept right through the critical vote. He was drunk and didn't come into the House.
He's going, Mr. Speaker, he's going troppo. He's going troppo. He's more to be pitied than despised. He's simply going troppo. And we just leave him with his little motion and with his loyal and trusted deputy sitting beside him.
Bernardi, we have 6.5 foot of ego, but not an inch of integrity. Not
such a sycophant, a social climbing sycophant, if ever there was one. There has never been a more sycophantic leader of the Labour Party than this one, and he comes here and poses as a tribune of the people.
For all that, perhaps, who knows, because of that, modern Australia has endured very little serious political violence. Even Australia's most hot-headed agitators have had little truck with notions of terrorism or assassination, still less such apocalyptic sunderings as insurrection or civil war. Indeed, Western Australia actually voted by a thumping margin to secede from Australia in 1933, and everyone else just sort of ignored them, and the attempted sedition was eventually more or less forgotten. The closest Australia has come to actual internecine warfare was a battle that occurred on December 3rd, 1854, on a hill near Ballarat in Victoria. It says much about Australia's essential placidity then and now that the newspapers of the time, such as The Age in Melbourne, reported what was, in the grand scheme of things, a relatively minor dust-up in tones of melodramatic anguish.
The shock of revolt vibrates through the colony. The majestic sanctions of British constitutional law are cast aside as powerless and inoperative, and a military despotism holds rule in the land. The reign of Queen Victoria has been superseded by a reign of terror. The first act in the sanguinary drama of revolution has been performed in this hitherto peaceful country, and men await its further development in trembling suspense. The ineffaceable stain of blood is redly stamped upon the pages of this young and favored country's annals, and all the waters of the Pacific would not wash it out.
Steady on. And there was yards more of that, by the way. It was all over in about 15 minutes, with fatalities in the low double figures. If you're going to have a civil conflict, that's how to have it. Especially if, as has proved the case, it bequeaths the kind of treasury of literature, music, poetry, cinema, and iconography, usually purchased at a much higher cost in blood. Although it is perhaps reasonable to ask what anybody should have been prepared to pay for the works of Buddy Williams.
Men of every nationality fought against the troopers to be free. Built up on a hill a great stockade, there a final stand they made.
And the Bushwhackers.
This flag of blue and silver stars says we're prepared to die for our...
It is known to Australians as the Eureka Rebellion. The animating cause, to boil it down to its barest essentials, was that prospectors on the Ballarat goldfields were hacked off with the onerous mining licenses they were required to purchase and the harsh enforcement of the terms and conditions by Victorian police. After a series of confrontations, affrays, and failed negotiations to end such strife, the miners resolved to take a stand. They built a wooden stockade and swore an oath. This is not a verite recording. The rebel miners of 1854 did not have an orchestra or indeed recording equipment.
We swear by the Southern Cross.
We swear by the Southern Cross.
To stand truly by each other. And to fight to defend our rights.
They ran up a handsome flag, the constellation of the Southern Cross in silver stars on a dark blue background, and they dared the authorities to do their worst. When the smoke cleared, at least 27 men were dead, mostly rebel miners. The revolt had been quashed, the legend ignited. 13 men stood trial for sedition and high treason the following year, a representation of the Eureka Stockade's multinational defenders, mostly Irish, reinforced by Dutch, Jamaican, American, and Italian. All were acquitted amid scenes of great public rejoicing in Melbourne. The miners' leader, Irishman Peter Layler, not only evaded capture after the battle, but was elected to Victoria's Parliament, minus the arm he'd lost as a result of his injuries, less than 12 months later. Layla rose to become Speaker of the House. He has since appeared on Australian postage stamps, a suburb of Melbourne bears his name, and he's been played on screen by the preeminent actors of different Australian eras. Chips Rafferty in 1949.
So they've brought in the soldiers, eh? That means more arrests, more digger hunts. And the trouble is, this time they're right.
We ask him to be our spokesman, and he speaks for them.
I speak for myself.
And Brian Brown in 1984.
It's my duty to swear you all in and take with you the oath to be faithful to the Southern Cross. Hear me with attention. The man who, after taking this solemn oath, does not stand by our standards, is a coward in heart. I order those persons who don't intend to take the oath to leave this meeting at once.
Eureka's most resonant contribution to modern Australia is the flag hoisted 167 years ago today. The Eureka Standard has been serially appropriated over the years by various kinds of self-styled Australian rebel, not all of them admirable. It is nevertheless still in the conversation when updating Australia's emblems is discussed, as a much more Australian flag than the actual Australian flag, a quarter of which is still someone else's. And that is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to our panellists today, Monocle's Chiara Ramella here in London and Chris Chermak in Zurich. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Lillian Fawcett. Our sound engineer was Louis Allen with editing assistance from Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time on Monday. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.